Hello, beautiful people. Thank you for joining us today on The Brief, our weekly show about politics. And anybody who's watching right now will notice that I am not joined by Marcos Melitzis, who is traveling or doing some such, but we have two fantastic people to work us through the hour here. And they work with Navigator Research. I have Brian Bennett, Senior Director of Polling and Analytics, and I have Gabby Parra, who is the Manager of Polling and Analytics. And I always refer, I've done a lot of stories about Navigator Polling. I love it. They have great graphics and bar graphs. I love their, they make their, one of the things I love most about it is when they do their polling, they make a lot of the crosstabs extremely accessible to people. And for me, I'm always in a time crunch. It's really easy for me to see the stuff, but they also have really unique questions. And so I write about them a lot. And my shorthand for Navigator is that it's a consortium of progressive pollsters. But I'm going to let Brian tell you just a little bit more about what Navigator Polling does.
Sure. Thanks, Carrie. So Navigator, which is, we launched the project in 2018. So we've been around for a little over 6 years. And the way that I like to characterize it is that it's intended to be a public opinion nerve center aimed at understanding the political and economic landscape that we find ourselves in. And from there, to understand what words, language, framing, arguments are the most effective to help progressive advocates on any number of issues. We do research on everything ranging from the economy to reproductive rights to the state of our democracy. And we do this by conducting both regular national surveys. We usually do them every couple weeks. We also have a vertical where we do research specifically in House battleground districts that are the most closely divided along conservative and progressive ideological lines to understand how those messages might be a little bit more nuanced relative to a national sample. And then we also overlay some qualitative research, mostly focus groups, kind of designed at trying to get at some of the more specific language that people are using in their day-to-day assessments of a lot of these different topics.
Right. So, and I want to welcome you. I should have done that. I introduced you, but welcome to both Brian and Gabby. I introduced you and I'll welcome you on the back end. That's not the way people normally do it, but we're non-traditional around here. Welcome, Gabby.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. So, one of the reasons that I wanted to have Brian and Gabby on is that there's been this tricky issue for the past, 2 years, basically post-pandemic, especially, where it seems like under Biden, the economy is getting better. Generally speaking, inflation has gone down. Generally speaking, gas prices have gone down. They're ticking up a little bit right now as we speak, but, the jobs numbers have been amazing. Millions and millions of jobs created under the Biden administration after the pandemic just, gutted the employment in the country. Even buying power is getting better, right? People's wages as compared to the rise of inflation, it's starting to increase. So, right, the buying power for consumers is getting better. But there's all this conflicting information about how, first of all, in the polling, when you poll the economy, it often polls, or inflation, it often polls as the number one issue for voters, or at least a very, very top issue for voters. I was just looking at polling this morning where it wasn't the number one issue for Democrats. Abortion was the number one issue in a poll that was done by, It wasn't abortion. It was actually the rise of extremism and fascism that was a top issue for Democrats in NPR Marist polling. But I'm kind of off on a tangent now. The economy has continued to sort of dog Democrats. Like, there's, on the one end, it's getting better. In fact, of all the Western nations, it's the best, right? In post-pandemic recovery under the Biden administration has been great. But consumers seem to not feel it in the same way. And Gabby has been looking at a ton of information that they just finished conducting this qualitative research, trying to get at why the numbers and the data don't reflect sort of the feeling of a lot of consumers. And Gabby, I'm wondering if you'll just tell us how you collected this research. It's newly out, and I think it's really innovative. So give us a window into how you gathered this information from consumers.
Yes, absolutely. Qualitative research is a great time to really dig into people's emotion, absent of any sort of answer. They have to come up with it entirely themselves. It's an open end, and it really gives them a chance to think and put things in their own words. So the qual that we did, or the economic journals that we did, was among over 30 participants across the country, mixed gender, mixed race, mixed age. And the main denominator among all of them was that they all felt like they were struggling within their personal finances. And we talked to everybody. Like, there were people who were cashiers, or people who were attorneys and principals, but again, all struggling currently under the economy. So we had these journals that took place over 11 days on an online format, to which we had, you know, 10 to 12 questions each day. The first 2 days were like these big, big questions. You know, how do you feel about the economy in the country? How do you feel about it in your area? What should the government be doing? And after those 2 days was followed by 4 days of asking about daily spending habits. So what is the first time that you think about finances every day? What did you spend on in the last 24 hours? How did that make you feel? And the point of this repetition was that even in a focus group in a singular time, right, people only have like minutes to say how they're feeling about how they're doing overall. And so when you ask the same question over the same number of days, you get to see a pattern. You get to see just more data and more answers and get some consistency right there.
Right. Great. Well, and so, just so you know, it's a lot easier in some ways. Well, I don't know. Brian may not agree with this. It seems easier at least to gather or at least analyze quantitative data, right? The numbers, right? But the qualitative data, you have to like read through all these journals. So we have 30 journals from people. And like you said, the overarching theme for them is that they feel like they're struggling. So it's worth noting at the top here that these are all individuals who feel like they're struggling in some sense or another. They're from, you know, groups across the spectrum. Brian, just tell me a second, how do you think about, when you think about the economy from a quantitative standpoint, from the data, right? What are you seeing from people in terms of how they feel about it?
Sure. They're not a small question, I'm not going to lie, but I'll try to keep my thoughts contained.
Just, if you could just do it in a sentence, Brian, that's all I'm asking. Is that too short a time frame, or I'm just kidding.
The vibes are bad. That's the sentence. So basically going back to all the way back to March 2020, when basically at the onset of the coronavirus pandemic, when Donald Trump was still president, that was the last time before, like the last survey we conducted before the pandemic broke out in earnest, was the last time we measured a positive overall attitude about the state of the overall economy. So that means that throughout the entirety of the pandemic, throughout the entirety of the Biden administration to date, it has been not just negative, but deeply net negative. And part of the reason we wanted to do this project is that by metrics, there are many, many positive macroeconomic indicators, including jobs and the unemployment rate, the lowering of inflation over time, but people just don't seem like they're actually feeling it. And I think a survey that we did in January has stuck with me deeply and was kind of the motivation for why we wanted to do this kind of deeper project, which was when we asked people, what are the metrics that you use to judge the strength of the overall economy? 89% of all respondents selected a personal economic indicator as to how they judge the strength of the overall economy, whether it was the cost of living, the rate of inflation, or their personal household income. And so what we wanted to really dive into with these particular participants is to kind of get a better explanation of why are some of the macroeconomic indicators not really resonating? And what does it feel like to feel like you're going through these kind of personal microeconomic struggles? And they were extremely revealing. And I'm happy to let Gabby talk about some of the key insights that we got from the groups.
Yeah, go ahead, Gabby. I'd love to just hear some of the key insights you got.
Okay, I'm going to just jump right in. And I apologize for my lack of brevity because I'm very attached to all of this research. So all of it seems just too important to me. But if we go from, I guess, like biggest topic down, which is when you ask people how the country is doing, the economy is still coming up. When I started this job a few years ago, it's definitely coming up less because back then it was very, very much about inflation. It was coming up in every single focus group, the top thing without even prompting. Now people are still struggling with cost of living, inflation's coming up, weather being bad for the economy or for their community overall. And a lot of people view themselves as not being where they expected economically. They thought they'd have more savings. They thought they could plan more for the future. And when you ask people how they feel about their personal finances, it's scared, it's anxious, it's worried, and that was consistent throughout. And thinking about on a daily basis, everybody in this study thought about their finances first thing when they woke up in the morning. It's, how am I going to get food to eat today? There was one quote of, how am I going to make sure my kid has enough money for ice cream at lunch today? How am I going to pay my gas and groceries? And people thought about it multiple times a day. And I think the part that stuck with me at the end as a key insight is we asked this question of, what do you want to see from your government to help you? And a lot of it was about helping the middle class, you know, making it a little easier to afford college, healthcare, housing, and things as such.
Right.
And if I could just add one thing to that last part, I think it was one thing that was very notable to me was that for basically all of these participants, they all generally saw that government was not doing enough for them, but they also saw a role for government to do more. They want an active role in government, whether it's anything from helping with housing assistance to lowering the cost of everyday goods to addressing corporate greed and making sure that corporations aren't being able to, you know, profiteer off of the pandemic and now this recent spat of inflation that has caused so much anxiety in many people's lives.
Do you think a majority of people, I mean, now I'm asking, this may not be fair, but I'm asking from a data standpoint, do you think a majority of people see the government as a potential ally in helping them get where they want to go? Because this idea of like, not that any of the old rules apply in terms of politics, but this idea of bigger government versus smaller government, right? That used to be like Republicans are smaller government and Democrats are bigger government. I mean, that's all messed up now, right? Because apparently, you know, Republicans think they get to just police women's bodies across the country. So, you know, that's a big government idea to insert yourself in something like reproductive rights, right? But, you know, for a long time, Republicans were all about small government. And what you're telling me is that now people do see a real role. Is there a majority of people? Can you extrapolate out, or can you not really say that with certainty, Brian?
Well, there are a few things that I would point to based on a lot of the research that we've done over the last year. So last summer, when we were in the midst of potential shutdowns of the government and the debt ceiling near crisis, we did one survey last summer where we basically tested a panoply of different policy solutions and asked whether people thought that they were spending, that the government was spending too little money on it, about the right amount, or were spending too much. And the conclusion of that was that across basically every program from childcare to our investment in Social Security and Medicare and many in education, many other programs, majorities thought that the government was spending too little money and investing too little in all of those programs. The only thing that people thought the government was spending too much on was tax cuts for the wealthy and large corporations. So that's one piece of the equation. The second is that there is a very clear mandate in our data for governments to do things that kind of both check corporate greed and make sure that the wealthy and large corporations are paying their fair share. In a national survey we conducted earlier this year, 79% of Americans agreed that raising taxes on the wealthy and big corporations is the right thing to do. In our battleground research, which is just a little bit more of a conservative electorate, we found a similar about 70% agreed with that, even higher share, nearly 4 in 5 Americans agreed that we needed to close tax loopholes for them. And so you can kind of see on these different angles from both this level of public investment that's helping the middle class succeed and thrive in this country. Mm-hmm. And also people see that checking the excesses of those at the top is also a necessary part of that. And there are majorities who agree with both of those.
Right, right.
I was actually going to say, you said the word ally and I like wrote it down and put it in a box. And it feels more in the sense that people feel not the government can be an ally, but it's their responsibility to help them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Because when people feel the economy is doing poor, it's reflected in approval ratings for government officials, but as well as when we're defining in both our surveys and our focus groups, you know, who do you blame for rising prices? Corporate greed has very much risen to the top of that. And the antithesis for people to like check corporate greed is the government. So therein lying more the responsibility.
Right, right. Okay, so one of the things, I just want to go back to something you said, Gabby, which is people talking about, I mean, first of all, I think it's fascinating that people basically opening their eyes in the morning and thinking, how am I going to pay for, you know, X, Y, or Z? I mean, that is, I admit that I sometimes think about, you know, money and or how are we going to afford this or that and, you know, save for the kids' education, all this stuff. But I don't wake up every morning and think, can I pay for lunch or can I put, you know, gas in the tank or something like that? So that, I mean, that tells you a lot about how anxiety producing this is for people who feel like they're struggling. But the other thing I thought was really interesting about what you said was people saying that they're not where they expected to be. And this goes back to this sort of idea, I think, of what a hangover we have from the pandemic, because people who were maybe sort of putting away money for the kids' educations or saving for a rainy day or, you know, saving up so that they could put a down payment on a house or something like that, some goal that they had in mind, they feel all of a sudden, based on the pandemic, the years we lost to it, the disruption in earning power, the immediate inflation afterwards, all that stuff, they're now behind. They're behind the eight ball. And I just think it's really interesting to note that people, I think in some ways what people are dealing with here, you know, sometimes I used to think about it more like, oh, people are have an existential concern or feel threatened by, gosh, when's the next shoe gonna drop? We don't know. But what I'm pulling away from some of the research that you have, and maybe that feeling does exist, it's just sort of this dread of we're living in such uncertain times, right? I do think that exists. But what I'm hearing from you and what I took away from what you said, Gabby, was that there's also this feeling that like maybe they were going along in a certain direction and then they just got completely thrown off course and they don't see a path to getting back to the direction that they were headed since the pandemic threw us all off course. I mean, is that sort of a fair, I don't know, inference from what you got from the journals?
To be honest, that's a great question. To be honest with you, when I was going through this, I wasn't linking it to the pandemic, but more so like if you asked in a vacuum, if you were at X age at this point in your career, you know, absent of external factors, like where did you think you would be? And so maybe that is brought on by the pandemic and it's shifting, but I feel like there was a quote that I read that stuck with me and just a theme throughout was that it should be easier. And at one point it was easier. And people talking about their parents, you know, my dad had a middle class 9-to-5 job, bought a house. We went on a family vacation every year. And now I have a 9-to-5 that barely covers my expenses, let alone being able to save for any home ownership. And I think it was more so about previous generations or how did I grow up and what were my expectations through that than more recent events.
Gotcha. Brian, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to, we didn't really like draw this out or tease this out. So this is kind of spitballing a little bit. But, you know, one thing that was kind of a key finding from these journals was the way that a lot of people explained their personal economic situation. It was done very much so in the context of like stress and solitude. And like that feeling of solitude, I think might be something that's a little bit of an extension from the pandemic, especially the way that people, a lot of times in the journals, a lot of the participants would say things like, you know, I feel like I don't know who to talk to about this. Like, I don't think the people that are closest in my life would have a sense that I'm financially struggling. And I think it just adds another layer of complexity to the depth of the anxiety that people are feeling.
I did notice that there was this sense of isolation and that, you know, and that people like they didn't feel, I mean, I think that this is definitely a hangover from the pandemic, but also I think is just true a little bit as our lives have gone more online and things like that, is just this sense of isolation from other people and sometimes not quite connecting. And so people feeling, you know, among other things, isolated about their finances. You know, their friends, their closest friends and families, as you said, Brian, family members might not know that they're struggling. And, you know, there's something about the loss of community that I really think has been difficult for people to absorb. And the pandemic was a sorting out and an isolating experience for all of us to some extent, right? And I think that the loss of community, even it sounds like even around the issue of finances, which is something that I never think about, does seem to have come through in these journals. I don't know if, Gabby, you want to?
Yeah, I mean, just to build off of Brian's and all of these wonderful points.
Sure.
Which I thought was interesting was that people who did report talking about finances to friends and families always like added in, but very generally, I'm talking about, oh, wow, aren't prices so high in general? Isn't it so much harder to buy a house, and never really centering the individual? And we had one specific question that was, what would people not know about your finances? Like if they were not to know something. And that was a question that had a very universal answer. Again, a lot of people don't know that I'm struggling. I had this, what on paper looks to be a great job where I work all these hours and I'm still not making ends meet. And I thought it was so interesting of how it is the first thing you think about when you wake up, you're thinking about it multiple times a day and yet not discussing with anybody else.
Yeah, that's wild. Talk about a disconnect. And, you know, people, I think, probably don't in some ways, especially people who feel like they live around, you know, and they are within the middle class. And, you know, that's a wide swath of Americans who believe they are in the middle class, right? Not wanting to sort of part ways with that or because, I mean, I think there's a sense among the middle, if you're in the middle class, you should be able to afford some basic thing, you know, your basics, plus a few luxuries here and there, and to do the things that were always considered part of the American dream at one point, buy the house, send the kids to school, that type of thing. And that just is no longer a given in any way. I want to move on now and talk a little bit about some of your takeaways from this. You know, when you think about what Democrats can do. And I think we touched on this earlier with this idea of greedflation, right? But from a policy standpoint, I mean, there's always a question of like how people are feeling and then what can you actually do as someone who's in the government, a politician who's running for office or in office, what kind of tangible policies can they either come up with or direct in such a way that it starts to hit at some of these things that people are struggling with? And so I wondered if you would both take a shot at weighing in on some of your takeaways that could be good for Democrats or the White House, you know, in terms of connecting with voters on these issues.
Sure. I can give it a crack. You know, I think that there's a few different things that we've seen across all of our research, including this. The first, I think, is that acknowledging people's pain points is quintessential. It is incumbent to just have a complete rah-rah, you know, unemployment rate is down, the overall economy is looking great, stock market's great. That's just not gonna completely do the trick. And it's important to acknowledge where people are. And most people are feeling very anxious about the economy overall, largely because of their own personal financial situation. Secondly, I think in terms of, you know, we know what conservatives are, what their argument's going to be. They're going to talk about, we need to reduce government spending, can't have government handouts. Like those are the arguments that we see them make all the time, and that will not go away. We have tested a lot of counter arguments to those arguments, and we have found very successful arguments that, you know, by 20 points more Americans agree with a more progressive worldview of the economy than kind of that dismal conservative economic outlook. I think the first starts with talking about the need to invest in these programs. Not, we need more investment, not less. So going back to the earlier point of, you know, people want to see more government spending in programs like Social Security, like Medicare, taking care of our veterans, childcare, education, et cetera. And making that affirmative case is absolutely necessary. Second, I think just in terms of defining who is for who and why, there is already kind of a baked in perception that conservatives and Republicans are more looking out for the wealthy, Democrats and progressives are more looking out for the middle class. That does exist. At the same time, there is a large generational challenge that I think progressives and the Democrats have on the economy, which is that conservatives argued for a long time lower taxes for everybody. And so there is kind of this, sometimes there is this instinct that we see in the data to kind of agree with like a lower taxes framework. That said, we also see in our data that when the debate is only had on that ground, then that's where progressives have a challenge. But we also know from so much data that we've seen dating back to Trump tax cuts in 2017, and which has remained resilient to this day, is that it is absolutely critical that progressives make the case on the issue of taxes in the economy, that they define that what programs they're for, that they say that they want to raise taxes on the wealthy and corporations in order to do things like reduce the deficit, in order to fund said programs, and that it's conservatives and Republicans who are the ones who are saying, no additional revenue, we're only going to cut programs. In a survey that we did last summer during the debt ceiling debate, 82% said that we should raise revenue to pay for programs like Social Security and Medicare. Well, 7% said that we should cut funding from those programs to reduce the deficit. That's a 75-point margin. And so the important piece of this here is that progressives and Democrats need to be credible when making all of these arguments and kind of taking stands on those public investments. I think the junk fee stuff is really important because those are, even though they can sometimes seem like small or trivial things, those are the things that people feel in their day-to-day lives. We've seen in our data that over 9 in 10 Americans have experienced at least one junk fee in the last year. So if you cut down on things like overdraft fees or ATM fees or credit card fees, like that's actually going to have material impact. And then making sure that people know who is responsible for implementing those policy or implementing for and or advocating for those policies.
Right. I mean, President Biden, I just, you know, I'm like going to display my ignorance here on the junk fees. I think that the White House did implement a new rule. Is that true under Biden about junk fees? Right. And there might be legislation paired with it. Is there legislation coming or is it just the new rule through the White House? Do you know?
So I'm like trying to put my policy expert hat on, which I am not. But I do believe the $41 to $8 fee thing was done by executive action. But
executive
don't
action.
Don't quote me on that.
No, I think so too. I think so too. And I wasn't sure. Gabby, do you know for sure or no?
I do not know for sure. Okay.
See, I mean, this is right. This is one of the issues, and not to, you know, but like we know a lot about what's going on in the political landscape, and sometimes like there's so much going on, it's hard to like remember exactly what has been done. I mean, we know who's fighting for this, right? But there's not a single one of us here who's going to be like, oh, is it Democrats or Republicans who are fighting to get rid of junk fees? It's clearly Democrats, right? But exactly what has been done is sometimes elusive, right? So, but let me just say this, jumping off of what Brian said, I just, you know, I think one of the things that I have started to learn as I've covered a lot of focus groups and polling is that it's always better for Democrats or Republicans, but, you know, of course, we're not making case for Republicans here, but it's always better for Democrats or politicians to be running on things where people have a predisposition to believing that they're good at that, right? So for instance, I mean, this is one of the problems with the economy is that voters often have a predisposition to believing that Republicans are better on the economy, you know, e.g. like the tax cuts that you were talking about, Brian, right? But Democrats have the advantage in voters having a predisposition in believing that Democrats are the ones that are fighting for them, right? So those are the grounds on which Democrats want to be making the arguments that they're fighting for, you know, quote unquote, people like you. They're fighting with doing, you know, taking executive action on the junk fees. They're fighting with the capping insulin for seniors at $35 per month. They're fighting with, well, the child tax credit for a while and, you know, some of the stuff that they packed into the Inflation Reduction Act, things like that. So, you know, I mean, this is where you can't just avoid the economy, but there are really strong arguments to make that voters are already predisposed to believing. Gabby, I wonder if you want to jump in here. We've talked a lot for a bit here, and I wonder if you want to throw in something from some of the research you've been looking at.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think something I wrote down while you guys were talking was center the individual. And across these 2 years since I've been doing this position, the legislation or accomplishments or attempted accomplishments that stand out the most are those that center the individual. You know, the student loan debt relief that unfortunately didn't pass, but that was something that was consistently brought up as, you know, okay, if you think about something that Biden's tried to do, it was student debt relief. We just did a release about the Inflation Reduction Act, and the point that people had heard the most about was capping insulin at $35 per month. And I think it gets at your point beautifully, which is Democrats are already more trusted in protecting and advocating for the individual, and therefore putting front and center economic policy that like furthers that and says, okay, we're gonna do this concrete thing to help you and ease the costs of every day, is I think a really great strategy. Because it also, going at Brian's earlier point, when you talk about a legislation that helps bring down everyday costs, you're recognizing that costs are increasing and that people are hurting, and you're presenting a solution.
Right.
I was going to say, I think that's really well put. And I also think that this is like somewhat related, but it's also somewhat unrelated argument. But I think one of the things that we've found is particularly when kind of doing some of these like back and forth statement tests and some of our quantitative research on how best to rebut conservative arguments, it has tended to reveal that when those arguments do center people and not process, it's like, I know it seems like a very obvious thing to say, but I think there is an instinct a lot of times to be like, well, you know, Republicans, you know, they're hypocrites, or they, you know, they want to do this thing over here, and it gets a little convoluted, when really the point to put it at the forefront at the end of the day is these are the policies that we think are going to help people like you, and policies that they're focused on are really more focused on helping those at the top at the expense of everybody else.
Right, right. Okay, so to wrap things up here, I want to play a clip from President Biden at the State of the Union. And this gets a little bit at, you know, let me set it up, but I also want to just say something about President Biden and Democrats, and particularly though President Biden, as he talks about the economy and making the case for it. And this is something I listen to way too many political podcasts. I mean, way too many. Okay. And it's not right for my family. I'm just like always like doing the dishes, listening to political podcasts, going for walks, walking the dog. So look, there are people who I tend to really love listening to and people who I have a love-hate relationship with, okay? David Axelrod is a person who I have a like-hate relationship with. He hates a little strong. I mean, like-dislike is probably just like, I do think he makes some good points. I'm always listening to campaign managers because I've never managed a campaign, right? And so they always have insights that I wouldn't think of. And they've handled candidates. So they always have insights about candidates that I wouldn't think of. Now, I have to say, the Hacks on Taps podcast that I listened to did not do a particularly good job of calling the 2022 election, okay? They had a lot more sort of, oh, I don't know, red wave type stuff on there. And I didn't think they did their best work on that, let's just say. So, but David Axelrod it drives him nuts to listen to President Biden because, look, President Biden he has gotten way more done than most people ever gave him credit for being able to do, including myself. Like, he wasn't my number one Democratic candidate, and he's gotten so much done against the odds with like one vote to spare always. You know, this just really impressive list of legislation, you know, legislative accomplishments that will, you know, end up working in favor and have already worked in favor of the middle class, in favor of creating working class jobs, et cetera. It just, you know, you can go down the line, and it's really an impressive string, right? But when he gets asked about the economy, he sort of reflexively, President Biden, wants to say, but I've done this and I've done that and whatever. And I do think this is true. And David Axelrod is always like, he has got to get off of that, right? He cannot just start listing the accomplishments he has. one of the superpowers Biden has is empathy. And if he could just tap more into his empathy first and say, you know, I realize people, we've done a lot. I realize people are still hurting. We have a long way to go. And, you know, here's what we plan to do to get it done. But if he could lead with the empathy, that would help by quite a bit. So I think it's probably maddening for the White House that they've done as much as they have and don't totally get credit for it. But he did have this, you know, he had this moment in the State of the Union that I think was a pretty good moment. It's something that you guys thought you might be able to riff off of. I wanted to be able to play a clip. I have to say, this might not have been Gabby's and Brian's favorite clip. It was the clip that we were able to access that seemed like it could offer something up. So let's listen to this to President Biden. I didn't want to be like, this is the clip they chose, right? This is the clip that we had. I offered them several clips and they said, this clip will work. So let's listen to President Biden from the State of the Union. It was a great State of the Union for President Biden. Let's listen to him talk a little bit about the economy, some of his accomplishments, and then let's have both Gabby and Brian chime in afterwards.
Sean, I was proud to be the first president to stand on the picket line. And today, Dawn has a good job in her hometown, providing stability for her family and pride and dignity as well. Showing once again, Wall Street didn't build America. They're not bad guys. They didn't build it, though. The middle class built the country, and unions built the middle class. I say to the American people, when America gets knocked down, we get back up. We keep going. That's America. That's you, the American people. It's because of you America's coming back. It's because of you our future is brighter. It's because of you that tonight we can proudly say the state of our union is strong and getting stronger.
Okay. Gabby, this is a little bit more rah-rah, right? This is more of a rah-rah thing. But based on what you've seen in some of the qualitative research that you've just been looking through, does that hit on any of the points? Do you think it hits, or is it really just, are we a little bit off in a different direction there?
I think as much as it can, right? As a singular speech in a moment in time can help people mm-hmm. feel better. In this part of the State of the Union, it actually leads up to Biden talking about holding big pharma accountable and capping insulin at $35 a month. So I think those two things paired, what it does is, first of all, talking about the middle class is definitely going to speak, or what I've spoken to people in the focus groups, and centering them as like one of the most important actors in the economy. And that line of when we get knocked back down, we get back up, is almost as beautiful acknowledging the pain without saying it's pain. Right? He's capturing us in a moment, again, that rah-rah of like, hey, don't worry, we're getting right back up. We're running right back up towards it. That's because of you. That's because of you. That's because of you. And again, it's acknowledging the pain while also putting in a lot of optimism, hope of what's yet to come. And I think having that optimism builds onto, and I'm going to do X, Y, and Z to help you every single day.
Brian, you want to chime in?
I do. I'm going to try to land three very big points in a very short period of time, because I know we're running short on time. I think, first of all, you know, one thing that we didn't really talk much about from the journals that was a very important finding for me is that, like, at the end of the day, a lot of what people are looking for is that just like one level of security that they can have, like just like a little bit of like a little bit of ability to save, a little bit of ability to get ahead, a little bit of ability to break down or to pay debt down. And, you know, in our battleground research, we asked a question a few months ago that was like, where would you rate yourself? Do you think you're like keeping up, you're struggling to make ends meet, you're not really making ends meet? 50% of everybody in the battlegrounds described themselves as just struggling to make ends meet. Only 10% said not really making ends meet. And the thing that it was not a partisan answer, which is kind of unusual because on a lot of economic questions these days, and this has been true for a while, but you know, Democrats, because party in power is President Biden, tend to have more positive ratings, Republicans more negative. If Trump wins, that would flip. But in this particular construct, you know, on struggling to get by and make ends meet, it's not really a partisan result. That's not the way the survey respondents view that. And in a similar question that's kind of unrelated, we also asked recently, which of these best describes the state of the American dream? And 59% agreed that it was once true, but isn't anymore. And again, it wasn't really a partisan response. And so, you know, you have this kind of like general feeling that is cross-partisan where people are just looking to kind of like get a little bit ahead. And I think that the sentiment that's expressed in that clip gets at that. The only other thing I would add is that we asked we did a whole survey that was our whole topic on labor unions a while ago. And President Biden kind of started talking about, you know, the importance of labor unions. And we did some messaging to kind of look at like, what are the best reasons to support organized labor? And 83% found this convincing. 44% found it very convincing. This is the statement. Hardworking Americans deserve the security and peace of mind of knowing they can afford to raise a family and retire comfortably, which is why it is important to support growth in union jobs. That's what people are looking for. It's about security and peace of mind at the end of the day. And that feels like the one consistency across what President Biden said, why people support unions, what people are looking for in the economy that they want to see.
Yeah. You know, President Biden has undoubtedly at this point proven to be the most pro-union president in decades, for sure. And certainly half a century, I would say. And I'm not like a presidential historian or anything like that, but it's like overwhelmingly true. Probably maybe since FDR or something like that. So it's been a long time. Him walking the picket lines with, you know, going as a sitting president and walking the picket lines, that was a big deal. That was a BFD in his own words. And he's now in the course of landing, you know, the endorsements of these of several major unions. He just landed another union endorsement that was a big deal. And what we know is that, and I'm just going to throw this in, like, this is kind of leading us into a whole nother, like we could do a whole nother hour, but anyway, we're not going to, I promise. But is that these unions are really, I mean, if the union votes matter, yes. I mean, I think if I remember, I just remember on NPR listening last night, and, you know, I think Joe Biden in 2020 won like somewhere around 60% of union votes, and Hillary Clinton won somewhere around 51% of union votes. So it makes a difference for sure, the votes themselves. But the bigger difference is the organizing bang that you get out of them. Oh, yes. Thank you. Walter, our producer, has just kindly dropped the North America's Building Trades Union, just endorsed Biden too, and cut a really amazing ad about Biden versus what Trump promised to do and didn't do for them in the 2016 election. Sorry. So anyway, but it's the organizing bang that they get out of, particularly in some of those upper Midwestern states, and how getting the union, the operation, and the boots on the ground and their organization, you know, doing the field stuff, is really like a much bigger thing than just the votes themselves. So I think the union aspect of this is going to turn out to be a real bonus and a real driving engine for the Biden campaign and President Joe Biden. But also, you know, I mean, he legitimately, this is one of the things that people legitimately believe about him, is that he's pro-union, he's pro-working guy, working gal, whatever. So I think that clip sort of spoke to that too. All right. Well, I want to thank Brian Bennett and Gabby Parra for joining me from Navigator Research with this new qualitative research that they're releasing. Just, I think some of it the end of last week, and some of it's coming. There's like a part two coming. Can you tell people where to find that stuff? Either one of you jump in.
Absolutely. You can find all of our reports. We release them publicly at navigatorresearch.org. You can go there to sign up for our newsletter. We send out quite a few releases every week on a bunch of different topics. You can also find us on social media, on Twitter at Navigator Survey, and on Instagram at navigator.survey.
Great. And I will, I'll plug them once again by saying that the other thing that I really like about them is that they do a lot of message testing. And so I like the message testing because I think that really all of us individually are much better messengers than any specific politician who's out there. And we're the heroes of the story. We're writing the history right now as we vote and talk to our neighbors and families and friends. And so we have the power, if we know how to talk about the issues, if we know how to engage people on them and draw them out rather than shutting them down. You know, if someone says something like, gosh, you know, the prices are the price of, you know, milk and eggs or whatever it is, the gas prices, they're crazy. You know, you can draw them out on that. And you might be able to agree with them, but you also might be able to say, gosh, you know, like, how's it hitting you? Is it eating? You know, like, are you having trouble? I mean, people need to feel that sense of community. And that's one of my biggest takeaways from the last several years is the loss of community we've had and the strength in regaining that community. So in any case, thank you both for joining me. Thank you, listeners and viewers. We appreciate having you. You are essential to the fight to save our democracy. And we will be back next week with another episode of The Brief.